Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. I'm Monique Coven. I'm the host. I'm a certified trauma recovery coach. I've worked for over 25 years as a social worker, and I'm a survivor. The Trauma Healing Podcast is for those who are healing trauma and finding ways to navigate through this messy, uncomfortable, and challenging recovery process. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information to validate, inspire you, support you on your healing recovery journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors, trauma experts, and trauma therapists in the field that will provide information on effective trauma healing modalities, tools, techniques, skills, all in hopes of helping you heal. If you'd like to find out more information on trauma recovery healing, please go to my website at www.cptsdcoach.com. I also have an Instagram and Facebook page at cptsdcoach. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. Before I introduce today's guests, I wanted to just say that I don't know how you're feeling right now, but a lot of people are feeling really, really exhausted. We're coming on to a year of COVID, and this whole change of life is exhausting for many people. It's, you know, not working anymore. Not working in a place where they're used to having social connections, not being able to see friends and family, and doing everything over Zoom, and just feeling really isolated and wondering when it's going to change. So I just wanted to say that I hear you. I feel it too. And that the only thing we can really do is just take the next right step in front of us, knowing that other people too are feeling the same as us and we're not alone in it. And I do believe that it's going to end, but you're not alone in it. And so if that can bring you even a little bit of comfort, I hope it does. So today I have on the podcast my friend and colleague, therapist Christiana Frion, and she is a therapist that works, actually she lives in France, and she works with trauma survivors, and she uses her own story and training as a therapist to help support people through the trauma healing. She's going to share a little bit about her own story. She's not going to share all the details because you know, that can be really triggering for people, but it is always nice, I know for myself too, when we hear other people, we know we're not alone, and we know that we can get better. There's something about connecting with other people's stories and their steps that they've taken, and the hope that they're actually able to move forward. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with Christiana. Hi, Christiana.
Hi, Monique.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for inviting me and having me here.
Yes, we've wanted to do this for a while.
Yeah.
So I guess we're going to start with you sharing a little bit about your own trauma story. Just share what you feel comfortable sharing, because it's always so fascinating when you know that a therapist that you, which you are, is also a trauma survivor, because you know that they get it. Like they get the PTSD. They understand the trauma and the impact. So yeah, if you could share just a little bit of your own story with us.
Yes, of course. I'm thinking, where should I start? I guess with the beginning, right? So
If I may say, I guess I experienced trauma from a very early age. It began with the moment when my mother got pregnant with some guy that she fell in love, and then that man didn't accept her and me. So she was kind of like rejected from the house, and also to know that I was born in a country where the communist era was flourishing, and a woman at 19 years old was not accepted with a child, not being married and not being in an official relationship. So, well, my mother being rejected by her family, she tried all that she could do to support me, but in the end, what happened was that I was taken by the social services in a local orphanage, and I guess that was the first time I really truly experienced trauma and like this separation. And years later, I understood that the fear of abandonment was so present in my life
May I
because of
ask
it.
you, may I ask you, what were you, did you live with her at all? Were you an infant when you were sent to the orphanage, or?
So I have no clear memory from my first, let's say, 5 years, I think. But I did have the chance to meet her for the first time when I was 24 years old. And so she told me, from what she told me, I don't have memories, I only have flashes. From what she told me is that I did have the chance to live with her for a while. And even with the first husband that she had, which was my sister's father. I'm the first from out of seven children. So I do know one of my sisters, which is the closest that I met when I was 22 for the first time. So I did live with my mom for a while and with her first husband, which unfortunately was having alcohol problems, and so yeah, we had to manage kind of that as well, my mom and I, especially during the nights where, from what she told me, we had to sometimes sleep outside in the street because it got too violent. But outside that, I don't have too much information. So I might have been with her for the first, I'd say, 1 year and a half, maybe two. And then I was taken to the local orphanage, my sister as well. So we were taken, both taken, but separated. And so at about 4 years, four and a half, I was adopted by a family, a couple that couldn't have a child. So they decided to come and visit, and they fell in love with me. And they took me, and my sister was taken away from this orphanage by her grandmother, her father's mother. So we were close for a while, and then we were separated, and then we found each other when I was 22 years old.
So you don't have much memory, if any memory, of before the adoption.
Oh gosh. I didn't have any memory at all, but there were some flashes coming back when I had my child. But just flashes.
And that's actually quite common. I've heard that before. No memories really, except flashes of what life was like in the orphanage.
I remember that I used to have a lot of nightmares in my adoptive family's house. And each time I had nightmares, and I think they were related to episodes in the orphanage, My parents used to deny it because actually they didn't tell me I was adopted. And actually, I found out at 22 when there was a neighbor. She was, I think, she was maybe a little bit drunk or a little bit more. And I just got a call from this person, and everything that she was saying was something like, "You don't belong here. You're adopted. You have no idea. Your mother is dot dot dot," and so on and so forth. So that was me finding out I was actually adopted. But I guess deep down in my body, there was something telling me I didn't belong into my adoptive parents' house. There was something telling me. And each time my parents would deny any nightmare I had, or I started doing like detective work, you know, and they would always say, "No, no, no, you'll get it later. You'll find out later. It's too soon for you," and so on and so forth. So
yeah. "You'll find out later" almost sounds like they're kind of like agreeing that you might be onto something, or what?
It was something like that. It was like I kind of started to understand this when my mother told me that I was about maybe 15, I think, that I was like, well, if there is nothing to validate from what I'm having, like nightmares or flashes, why do you keep telling me I'm going to understand later and I'll find out later? What is it to find out? So, yeah, that was it.
Yeah.
So,
So what was your life like with your adoptive family?
I guess at the beginning it was like, I would do anything if you could just keep me and love me. And at the beginning, in my first years of development, it was, "Oh my God, this is perfect. This is great." I think when I look back, I think this is what I thought as a child. And later on, becoming a teenager, I realized that actually it wasn't that good. And the first element that helped me realize that was when my mother started having coffee together, and I became like what we call today with this term, like the parentified child.
Yeah.
When my mom would start crying and just, I would become her therapist, you know? And so I was like, this is not normal. And at that time, it wasn't normal. From what point of view, if I would say it, it wasn't normal for her to suffer that much and just come and cry in front of me without doing anything. And then I realized the whole thing was not normal. And I also later on realized that I was living in a dysfunctional family. And, you know, one of my parents, my mother being kind of like the codependent, I don't want to label her. But if I should use like the terms that we use today, this is what it is. And then my father being somebody very toxic, like grandiose and, you know, wanting to control, wanting to have it all. And yeah.
So when you were being a therapist to your mom, and I know because I was one too. How old were you when she used to sit and have coffee with you? Are you saying like a child? Were you a preteen?
So we started a little bit later. I think it was about when I was 16. But the discussions, the very deep discussions about life in general, and like when you're forced to become an adult before your age. I remember being as early as 11, 12.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. And we really take on that role of like, I got to fix her, help her, figure it out for her.
Absolutely. Because when we're smaller children, we believe that, oh my God, if I do something right, if I do something good, even if it's only listening to my mother, maybe this will help her be better with my dad, and maybe all the arguing and the fighting and the screaming will stop, you know. But
yeah,
it actually got even worse and worse. So I couldn't do much than listen to her, maybe cry with her sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I even remember at the end of it, when I was about 18 or 19, just telling her, why don't you divorce? I mean, what's the point in all of this? But, you know, it didn't happen. Yeah. So they're still together. And yeah, I think I realized that at one point, if somebody, as much as I wish to help someone or to kind of, I wanted to rescue my mother, unless she had taken that decision for herself, I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
But we didn't know that as kids.
No. Mm-hmm. No.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And it's such a heavy burden to put on immature little ones who are not fully developed themselves. Mm. And yet, becoming these parentified little children, adults, it's so burdensome. Mm. And did you find, because I know I found that in many of the people I work with, that what tends to happen is we tend to continue to feel responsible for them. Did you find that was your experience at any point? Emotionally?
Yes. Up until to the point I realized I had to maybe not detach myself, but almost kind of like put that kind of boundary of like, okay, I really need to realize that it's not my responsibility. Even if I'm here to help, I really need to detach myself from this, like you so well said, burden.
It
did. It definitely did happen at the beginning when I went into the therapy and field.
Yeah, I remember a therapist, and I shared this on the podcast before, but when I first got married and it was still the same where the calls were coming to me, and it was not like so much like, how are you? And what are you, what's going on with you? It was more like, hello. And then it was just like a dumping.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to the therapist, like, I don't want to. And he was like, well, why are you answering? And why are you? And I'm like, because I have to, so ingrained. And we really dug deep with that. And I realized, my gosh, I felt like if I didn't, she might do something terrible. Mm-hmm. And then I would be responsible. Mm-hmm. So it's that responsibility that we still tend to carry on with us. Mm-hmm. So how were you able to kind of do that, to see that, oh, I really need to set some healthy boundaries?
Oh, with my parents and my mother especially?
Yeah, your caregiver.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, I tried several times when I was in my country. Mm-hmm. It didn't work, because each time I would try, there would be either my mother coming and crying and kind of bringing back that self-guilt part, or mm-hmm. my father mm-hmm. who would use his tactics to kind of make me feel guilty for what my mother goes through. So mm-hmm. I tried several times. I saw it didn't work. And at one point, right before meeting my husband, I was planning to quit the country, just go into another country and mm-hmm. work there. And so in the end, I finished up with meeting my husband and moving to France. So moving from Romania, where I'm originally from, to France. And even after moving to France, it took me like more than 1 year, even having like 2004 500 kilometers. It took me more than 1 year to realize, God, I really need like to unburden myself and to put this kind of boundary, because otherwise I would have like continued to feel that responsibility that was put on my shoulders.
Yeah. And I mean, I know a lot of people are listening and they're in that situation. And it's exactly that. It's a burden, heavy burden. And when you said the word, I had to unburden. That's exactly it. And it's not easy. But it's necessary.
It's necessary, and it can feel terrifying. It can feel like, oh my God, what am I doing? I cannot do this to my mother or my father. And then the question is, well, if I cannot do this to my parents, then what am I doing to myself?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because the question is, at the end of the day, when I put the phone off and I stop talking to my parents, I am the one staying with me and what's left of me.
Right. Mm. Right. Yeah. That's it. And, you know, I always say like, we're meant to carry really like one nervous system. It's next to impossible to carry other people's nervous systems as well. But that's really generally what we do without even realizing it. And thinking somehow we have the power, as if we're God, to be able to like fix them or change, you know, what's going on in their thoughts and body. And we just don't have that kind of power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And as long, long as those persons, those people, even if it's our parents, caregivers, or brother, sister, friend, don't decide and don't take their part of responsibility for doing the work.
Yeah.
There's no possible way that we can carry it all.
Yeah. And I think another message that, again, I don't know how it happens, but it gets in there. Somehow we come to believe, even though our own needs were not met, we come to believe that if we don't help them, we're selfish.
Yes.
And so you can almost hear those, but you're selfish.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Like,
It's so deep ingrained.
I know. That's it. So, is there anything else that you wanted to share about your story?
No, I think I touched. No,
okay.
It's okay.
Okay. So then, you know, you decided that you wanted to work with people who have been through trauma, and that's the kind of work you do. So what kind of areas do you often work with?
Okay. So because I also went through this, and when I speak went through this, it's like having the flashbacks and emotional flashbacks and the hypervigilance, nervous system dysregulation. So this is the kind of areas. So it's like CPTSD, nervous system dysregulation. And there's also recently, I realized I feel very curious about attachment, and also realized I have clients that come with attachment. I don't want to call them issues, but like,
attachment wounds.
Exactly.
I mean,
thank you so much.
More than that, like it's like a wound almost feels like mild.
Attachment. So I'm like wanting to. Complex trauma is like big, right? I mean, there's so many layers.
Yeah. so many layers.
There might be someone coming because their flashbacks are so intense, or somebody else that's telling me, oh my God, I feel so activated all the time. Like, hypervigilant, right? So there, even though we know that CPTSD has a lot of elements, like the toxic shame and social anxiety and the flashbacks and the hypervigilance, it doesn't mean that the same person will come with all of this. So I'm just like being there and guiding them to, okay, how can we undo this and learn your body and nervous system that is safe to live again and detach from the meaning that your mind also created around the traumatic experience. So
yes, it's interesting when you said how can we learn to be safe again, and for many complex trauma survivors there's no safe again. There was never safety. At the talk about attachment at the start, the foundation was not safe. Not that we don't experience, as we know with our polyvagal training that you and I did or doing, is that, yes, there are glimmers of safety, but the foundation is unsafe. Yes. And so this is what we want to show our clients, is that we can learn to be safe and to grow it.
And that we have, there's this possibility for us. Whereas before we might have been like feeling like, oh my God, there's no way out, or I'm feeling so stuck.
Yes, right.
And it's like,
that's right.
Part of the healing and one step forward is to learn. And maybe remind ourselves that we have a choice, and there's this tiny possibility that we might learn for 5 more seconds to feel safe again in our body. So it's like baby steps, but like, okay, I'm going forward.
Yes. And that really, like, it is baby steps. I know we don't want to hear that. We want to hear, all right, so I do this, and then like 6 weeks later, it's all gone. I'm all better. I'm safe. And I wish, but that's just, it took us whatever age we are, all those years and all those patterning for us to be a certain way. And it's going to take a little bit of time to, to rebuild.
Course, absolutely. And it's like this voyage of unlearning and unlayering, and there are so many layers that once you're done with one, there's another thing coming up. So
exactly. So I wanted to ask you also, what do you think, or what does the word resilience mean to you?
Yes. Well, when I think about resilience, and actually this is one of the words that helped me create my website logo and my symbol. I actually, to relate to my symbol, my favorite symbol is the phoenix bird. So resilience is like rising from the ashes. And even though when we speak about trauma, there can be resilience either before the traumatic events, or we're building resilience with each traumatic experience, resilience is also realizing we still have one more chance to rise from our ashes. And it's like this ongoing rising from the ashes, and no matter how many times, and I guess it's kind of very personal concept for me, because I felt like no matter how many times I got on the ground, somehow, I don't know how, I don't know from where, I just got back on my feet and like rising from the ashes. So resilience is not only being tough and keep moving and keep doing, and no matter what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to keep moving, smiling or like pretending it's okay. It's also taking yourself from the ground up and moving.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. What's coming to my mind is when you said that was for so many of us who have been through horror and overwhelming experiences, I think of freeze. Mm-hmm. And it's like you know, you're just frozen, and it's like a thawing out or a unfreezing process. And it's yeah. Yes. So this was a lovely conversation. Is there any last words you want to say before we close?
I didn't think about this. Just to the fact that I feel so grateful and thankful to be here. That the main reason for me personally being here is maybe someone who's listening will feel a little bit more empowered, and maybe this will help someone somewhere. And if it does, then I'm thankful and I'm grateful.
Oh, that's so beautiful. That's so lovely. Yeah. You know, even hearing somebody who's feeling, you know, what we have felt so many times, just hearing another person that has been through the same and really gets it and putting language to it, there's something about that shared experience, and knowing you're not alone in it, and also knowing that you can, as you said, like, you know, rise from the ashes, and that's, even if that means rising and then falling again, but then you're going to rise again, fall again, but that there's hope to be able to take these steps and move forward and change. So that's really lovely. If people want to find out about your work, how can they find you?
So I have my Instagram page, which is my name, Christiana, underline, so my family name is French, so it's F-R-E-O-N, Freon, or the French, Freon, Freon.
Freon. Moi, je parle français, alors je peux dire ça. I'll put it in the show notes.
And then the website, and they can find out a little bit more about the different tools that I can use. So it's www.christianafrion.com. So
wonderful. Okay, so thank you
for having me. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Trauma recovery coaching is a safe place to begin to heal. One of the areas that we work on is nervous system regulation. As we know, trauma impacts our nervous system. We can find ourselves experiencing chronic anxiety or disconnection. And so learning about your nervous system, as well as navigating these regulating tools that you can use to help you feel safer and regulated, is so important. And that's part of the work that we do together. To find out more details about the trauma recovery coaching process and what options are available, visit my website at www.cbtsdcoach.com. Mm-hmm.